Everybody, the House State Affairs Committee will come to order at about 8:05. This morning on the agenda, we have submission bills. We've got HB 71, which relates primarily to length of legislative session. SB 33, disposition of service members remain. And HB 92, titled Laos Vietnam License Plates. So, with that introduction, we'd like to start, please, with HB 71. And I believe Representative Seaton, well, first of all, let's take roll here.
Representative Peterson?
Present.
Representative Johansson, not present. Representative Wilson?
Here.
Representative Seaton?
Here.
Representative Keller?
Here.
Representative Gruenberg, not present. Chair Lynn?
I am here. I don't care what they all say, I am here. Okay. Representative Seaton, would you like to please introduce, I believe it was HB 71.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'd like to read the bill. Section 1 AS 24.05.150B is repealed. Pretty simple bill. And, Mr. Chairman, I would like to have my staff member, Katie Kester, run us through the bill and the reasons for it.
Very good. It's been my experience that the shorter the bill, the more difficult it can be. I'd like to recognize Representative Gruenberg has joined us. Good morning. Please state your name and begin.
Good morning. Katie Kester, staff to Representative Seaton. You have before you House Bill 71, which is...
Pull the microphone closer.
House Bill 71, which, as Representative Seaton stated, repeals the 90-day session that was passed by ballot initiative in 2005. The House Bill 171 in 2007 directed legislative counsel to appoint a committee to look at and evaluate the 90-day session. The House members of that committee were Representative Gruenberg, Representative Edgman, and Representative Seaton. And the conclusion was that it was time to repeal the 90-day session. You will see that those three members are all prime co-sponsors on this legislation. One of the ways that the House members of the committee evaluated the effectiveness of the 90-day session was a survey. You probably got lots of reminders in your inboxes and phone calls. There was a survey on 90-day session with a number of different questions, and that is in your packet. 31 House members responded, and overwhelmingly the conclusion of that survey was to repeal the 90-day session. I want to let you know that you have on your desk a color printout of the survey from the House version of the survey. It's the same information that's in your packet. We just felt like it might be a little easier for you to read in color. And the I'm going to be highlighting a few of those questions in this brief presentation, and those are circled in orange, just in case you want to follow along. Also, you can find the links to the survey and also a survey of staff members' comments in the report on Representative Seaton's website if you want to look into what us lowly staffers had to say about it. So the first question number 13 wanted to highlight, and these is asking members if they believed that going to a 90-day session cut down on the legislature's operating costs. And you will see that 26 of the respondents, 92.9%, believed that it did not cut down on costs. Question number 14 asked if they were able to, representatives, if they believed they were able to communicate as effectively with their constituents during the shortened session. And you can see that 83.3% of respondents felt that communication was not as effective. Question number 18 asked if they felt there was less time for members to schedule personal meetings with constituents and members of the public, and 93% felt that that was the case. Some of the comments in the comments section of the survey said that this gives more power to those who know the interworkings of the system, which is generally not to your average member of the public who has a lot of other things on their plate. Another comment was that a particular member felt like they had less time to meet with other representatives, which is particularly important as end of session rolls around and you know, you're trying to learn about bills and figure things out. Question number 21 asks House members if they felt that their personal legislation was adequately reviewed by committees of referral. I see that 90% of respondents felt that it was not. Question 31 posed the question that in the ballot initiative language, the pro-ballot initiative language, it claimed that 27 other states have a shorter session than 120 days, and what effect the fact that other states can get it done in less time has on representatives. And as you can expect with our very Alaska is unique mindset, 83% said that really what other states do don't have any bearing on what they feel is appropriate for Alaska.
In other words, we don't care what they do outside.
Exactly. Question 33, do you believe that decreasing the time the legislature is convened cedes some of the power to the governor or the bureaucracy? And 86% felt that that was the case, and one of the comments was, and that is not a happy thing.
Would you repeat that, please?
One of the, in the comments section, the, a member said that is not a happy thing, to cede power to the bureaucracy. This is a chart. Just the next few slides and also in your packet are just a few informational slides, questions you might have when looking at the history of the legislature. This is a chart of legislation introduced and passed to give you kind of an idea of the volume of work that gets done around here. And the change between, for example, the year 09, 010, and 07, 08, and bills passed was four bills more the year before. A slight uptick if you go back to when we had a 120-day session, but not a real substantial decrease in the number of bills introduced or passed.
Could I inquire, Mr. Chair?
Representative Grunberg.
Yeah, Katie.
And I might point out you were a member of the team, the subcommittee, right?
Yeah, I'm on the team.
Okay.
I hadn't seen this chart before. And is it true that in 81, 82, there were 2,150 bills passed, introduced?
No. That's how many was introduced.
2,150 bills introduced?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, that's my understanding. There was no limit on session until a constitutional amendment was passed, I believe, right here in the 90s when you see that big downswing in legislation. So you certainly can say that the 120-day limit served to limit legislation.
That's amazing. Thank you.
One of the arguments in favor of the 90-day session in the voter pamphlet was that it would increase the number of candidates, and they actually quoted the Juneau Empire. Reducing time away from family and other work also might encourage more people to run for office. Competition and choice only helps the democratic process and ultimately might boost the caliber of candidates. You can see from this chart that there's actually been a steady decrease in the number of people running for office.
That's for legislative office, not all the other offices.
Correct, for legislative office. And this, the 90-day session would affect legislative office, House, and Senate.
And so to repeat that, there were fewer candidates of all persuasions running since we instituted the 90-day session. Is that correct?
Chairman Lynn, that is correct, for state, Senate, and House races. This chart details the length of legislative session since statehood. There's also some information below about special sessions. And there is, in your packet, a legislative research report with numbers on this. But this, just to kind of give you an idea of how things have changed once we steadied out to our constitutionally mandated session. And it does give you a visual, at least, of special sessions. You can see the length of special sessions, a couple of very significant issues that the legislature has taken up in the past few years. And this chart kind of details what other states do, what their limits are on their length. And you can see that with a 120-day session, with the 180-day session biennially, the comparison, we are kind of in the middle there, and a bunch of states don't limit it at all, which is the kind of off the chart lines that you see. So if we were to repeal the 90-day session, we would basically be left with the constitutional requirement of 120 days, 121 after it has been deemed the appropriate interpretation of this language. So repealing the language does not preclude the legislature from meeting in less than 120 days. It just removes that limit. You do have a fiscal note in your packet, and Shane Miller from Legislative Affairs is here to speak to that. Cost, of course, is one of those big questions that gets thrown around when you talk about the legislature. The Legislative Affairs estimates the cost to be about $800,000 for 30 extra days of session. However, in previous years, they've just, instead of eliminating that from their budget, they moved that into the special session category of their budget. So they still are authorized for the same amount as they have been previously under the assumption, which bears out sometimes and doesn't, that there will be a special session, and they want to make sure they have that covered, because a special session can be more expensive than a regular session, mostly because getting everyone somewhere is quite expensive. You think it's just $1,000 each person, but then when you think of all the other things that entails, people from rural communities, and that adds up. So those are the kind of points I wanted to bring to the committee's attention, and I'm available for questions.
Thank you very much, Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you. I'd like to. I was very interested in the fiscal note. Do we have anybody else who's going to testify from LAA on this bill?
Only have one person signed up. That's Shane Miller, finance manager, and she's from LAA. And questioned only, but I'm sure she might be able to respond.
I think
finance guy question.
You breathe a sigh of relief.
Did you want to ask her this question?
I'll ask Ms. Miller that. Shane. Mr. Miller. Excuse me.
Oh, Mr. Miller. I beg your pardon. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Shane Miller. I'm the finance manager for the Legislative Affairs Agency.
Step back a little bit. There you go.
Do I need to go again, or was that okay?
Okay.
Yeah. Do you start over?
Yeah. No, I can't hear.
Okay.
Okay.
So, again, for the record, my name is Shane Miller. I'm the finance manager for the Legislative Affairs Agency.
You one who pays us?
I'm sorry, what?
You pay us? You're the one who pays us?
Yes, my office processes per diem checks and handles the allowance accounts. And
I caution the committee to
pays bills. And
be very polite in the question that you ask this man.
Yes.
Go ahead, sir.
So I don't have a presentation prepared. I'm just available for questions.
Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you. I'm not great at fiscal notes. And
did you want to? But I thought you wanted to ask.
I'm sort of prefacing.
Oh.
So don't expect a great question. The
No comment. Go ahead.
I won't promise a great answer then.
Okay. There's a chart that Katie had up that talks about the length of the various special sessions. And we've had, since we didn't have a special session last year for the first time in quite a while, if I recall. My question is, how is this? I don't understand what you've done in the fiscal note. It sounds to me like there was supposed to be a cost savings when the session was shortened from 120 days to 90 days. But the appropriation for the legislature remained the same, and the money was squirreled away into an account, put into an account, I won't use an animal's name in vain, to take care of additional potential special sessions. However, there had been special sessions in the past. So where did that money come from? It must have been a savings somewhere. This doesn't make sense to me, and maybe I'm just ignorant.
Okay. Through the chair to Representative Grunberg, my understanding, I'm new to the agency, but the when the vote went into effect to reduce the session to 90 days, the common thinking at the time was that that would cause there a stronger likelihood to be more special sessions. So the funding was put into an allocation for special sessions. And it's my further understanding that after the 90-day session began, there were an increase to the number of special sessions and an increase to the cost. So that was good budgeting to make sure that that money was available. Prior to that, it's my understanding that we would have to come back to the legislature for additional funding if there were special sessions, because there was not a contingency fund for that contingency.
Okay, may I follow up, please?
Follow up.
So I'm not concerned about whether you had to come back in a supplemental. I'm looking at it on an annual basis. Presumably, if your logic is that a shorter session will yield more and more expensive special sessions, then logic would dictate the opposite would be true too, right? That if the session were longer, you wouldn't need as many expensive special sessions, so there would be a savings. I don't see that reflected in the fiscal note. I don't know if it's Representative Wilson. Did you have,
Representative Wilson, do you have a comment?
I do know that there's a lot of committees that with a shorter session, we really don't get our work done, and so we haven't always had a special session, but there have been committees that meet in the interim that didn't used to meet in the interim, and so the money gets gobbled up one way or another. And so if we go back to the longer session, we will have a little more time to do the work that we're here to do, and we won't have to have quite as many committee meetings during the interim. And so hopefully it balances out. That's what I'm thinking.
And I might point out, for public's benefit, that when you have a committee meeting during the interim, you cannot vote on anything. You can't pass bills out of committee, and you can't vote. You just talk. Continue, please. Oh, I'm sorry.
I think I was still asking.
Representative Grunberg and then Seaton.
Thank you. So thank you for filling that in. This part of my question. These savings are not reflected in your fiscal notes, though. Why not?
So through the chair to Representative Grunberg, I'm not sure exactly what you mean by savings. The fiscal note was based on what the costs were for the 2010 session, and broken out into a daily rate, and then using that number to run it back out 30 more days, and that's where these numbers come from.
I also like to point out Representative Johansson has now joined us. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'll come here. Okay. I'm going to caution you.
Okay. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the fiscal note, I think it's important to to look in that second paragraph where it says, it is the intent of House leadership that the funding for the additional 30 days be included in this fiscal note and the special session contingency account remain to provide adequate funding for future special sessions. So, you know, I don't think that we should presume that LAA is taking on themselves the putting things in special accounts. I mean, we have it in here that this is the way it's been directed through the House leadership to maintain the funding. But I think that we should not try to draw direct correlations between the costs and the benefits and all. I think that what we can see, though, is that costs for special sessions are more. The potential has turned out that there are more special sessions to go to a direct dollar amount of that or committee, more numerous committee hearings is extremely difficult. But I think that the thing it does do is it draws into question, just like the survey of all of the House representatives that was presented earlier, is that the idea that the 90-day special session was going to save significant revenue is also called into question as being as whether that's come true or not. And so if we can't really balance and can't determine those costs and look at the number of committee meetings or the number of special sessions and draw direct conclusions, what we can do is look at those and say, well, the balancing of costs there also says that reducing to 90 days wasn't a direct total cost savings either. And so I think that that's the important part of looking at these kind of figures and what's happened with the way the legislatures had to operate as far as fiscally goes.
You can't just say 90 days is less expensive just by subtracting salaries and per diem and keeping the lights on down here and everything else. It's more than that. Not to mention what happens to, you know, the quality of the testimony and research we do and processing of various bills.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, if I could.
Yeah, please.
Yeah. Yes, and also there was, you know, another cost factor, and that was that, as was shown in the survey, that representatives felt that there was definitely more difficult to get staff to come from their district down for a 90-day session for 3 months. And it used to be that they had to provide their own transportation to Juneau and back, and so one of the responses that was made was that to be able to get staff, the Legislative Council changed the requirements, so now we do provide staff transportation. And I'm not saying that that goes away or comes back, but there's a lot of interrelated cost issues that it's very difficult to say one thing is definitely either cheaper or more expensive.
And again, it's not just, you know, the cost of our staff, and basically staff is as important as legislators, really. But to get qualified people who can help us in the various things that we all have to do as representatives, and get somebody who's just going to be here, for 3 months, it's difficult to find good staff. No matter how many days we meet, whether it's 5 days a year or 365 days, it's always going to be difficult to find good staff. Fortunately, most of us have, but it narrows the pool that we can work among. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll have to first submit that I wasn't here when we had 120-day sessions. I've only been here when we had 90-day sessions. But I have heard that the 120-day sessions overlapped the beginning of the tourist season here in Juneau, and that made housing actually a little more difficult to get because some people or some property owners wanted to rent their rooms out to tourists rather than to legislators because they felt they might be able to get a higher daily rate versus a lower monthly rate that we may get. And since we're meeting 90 days now, we're done by the time this tourist season starts, we're out of here. So I just thought I'd make that point.
I would think also that with a 120-day session, there's more time to get needed business done, and ergo less possibility of a special session. And special sessions, of course, are very, very expensive, very difficult, for both staff and representatives and all the support staff is required because it's the middle of the tourist season down here. But that's not as important as how well we review the bills and how well, you know, we serve our constituents with the legislation that we review and perhaps pass. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Back to the fiscal note itself. AS 2408035, which we've discussed in this committee before, deals with fiscal notes. And if I may read the relevant portion of this.
It was not too long.
It says, before a bill, et cetera, is reported, there shall be attached to the bill a fiscal note containing an estimate of the amount of the appropriation increase or decrease, quote, that would result from enactment of the bill, unquote. I'm going to quote that phrase again. That would result from the enactment of the bill. The requirement of law, Mr. Miller, through the chair, is that the fiscal note should be limited to the amount of change that was caused by the bill. Your language in paragraph 2 states that it's the intent of House leadership that funding for the additional 30 days, be included in this fiscal note and the special session contingency account remain to provide adequate funding for future special sessions. It sounds like the additional money does not result from the bill itself, but from a choice of House leadership. Doesn't result from the bill itself, but from the choice of House leadership to keep the special contingency account. That's a management decision, doesn't result from the bill, and doesn't meet the statutory requirement. It's not caused by the bill, but it's caused by a management decision of House leadership. Any comments, sir?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, since the bill restores the session to 120 days, I would say the fiscal note, per guidance we had from House leadership, reflects the cost of restoring the extra 30 days to session.
May I follow up with one?
Follow up.
If they hadn't decided to keep that special account alive, if that decision hadn't been made, would your fiscal note still be $864? I'd like you to eliminate that management decision from your calculation. What would your calculation be if that decision hadn't been made?
I think I would need to get back to the committee on that, Representative Grunberg.
Mr. Chairman?
Everything Wilson.
I don't think that's relevant under this circumstance because the decision was made before. The decision wasn't made just now. The decision was made at the end of when we started having 90-day sessions.
May I respond to that, Mr.
Quickly.
The reason it was made was because leadership foresaw more special sessions because of the shortened regular session. That assumption would no longer be true if we have a longer regular session. So there's no need for the special contingency fund, presumably because we'll have enough time. They only apparently made that decision after the session was shortened. If it goes back, I question the need for all these special sessions.
Okay. Follow-up, Attorney Wilson.
The reason that there's no increase in pay or increase in the fiscal note is very simple. Because the decision was made before, instead of putting that money back in the general fund or whatever, because they were concerned about special sessions, they kept it there. It didn't get used, but they kept it there just in case that we did have extra sessions, special sessions. Now we're going to take that same money, and it's going to be used for a regular session. So there's no increase in money.
May I respond?
Quickly, but I want to get Reverend Johansson.
I agree, but the fiscal note seems to be for an additional 864.
Through the chair, yes. The fiscal note does increase the. It is an increment for 846,000 to
it's
cover
an
the
additional
extra
864.
And then in the second paragraph there, House leadership wants the extra funds to remain in that special session contingency account for future special sessions.
Okay, Representative Johansson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just get a little bit frustrated. First of all, gleaning why certain things were determined. I don't know how the representative knows that. Apparently, this was done. I mean, unless you were sitting in the House leadership meetings, you don't know what they were talking about. Also, you know, this fiscal note is written by the legislature. The LAA works for us. It's no different than Ms. Brewster writing a fiscal note for DMV. We can put any fiscal note we want in here. And the majority is in charge of the legislature at this point. So if leadership decides to write this fiscal note the way it's written, then so be it. They have their reasons. Unless you are in the meeting with leadership discussing it, I don't know how you can possibly surmise by using words like apparently or the reason it was there. I mean, maybe you've had a discussion with the speaker through the chair, but I doubt it. So I don't know why we're wasting any time on this. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Jeremy Wilson, follow-up.
I think it was well said.
I beg your pardon?
I think Representative Johansson said it well.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I was just looking at this chart where it showed the special sessions and the number of regular sessions and their length. And when they started having the 120-day session every year back in 1986, and for the next 20 years until we went to the 90-day session, there were 15 special sessions. So I don't see a correlation between the length of session and whether there's a special session or not.
It depends on the issues on the table at that time.
Right. So I don't think there's a correlation between a 90-day or a 120-day session, whether there's a special session.
Well, special sessions are unpredictable. We don't know what's going to happen tomorrow that it might engender a special session. No way to know. We have to have it. We have to have it because we need to do the people's business in regular session or special session. Representative Satan? Okay. Any other questions? Representative Wilson.
I have a question for the sponsor. So the bill as presented, what it does, it takes out the part that says the legislature shall adjourn from regular session no later than 120 consecutive days. So it actually goes back to what it was before. So it goes back to here. And instead of just going back to here, it goes back to here?
Well, it just changes from 90 to back to 120. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No, the bill simply eliminates the 90-day session in statute. This is a constitutional language, and so we would be left with the constitutional language of 120 days after convening. So it's 121 days. And that, again, is a maximum. If the House and Senate decide they want to meet for 115 days, that's the maximum length of session, not a required amount.
And what's the effective date on this?
The effective date would be at the next legislative session.
So this would affect us when we come back in January.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Keller.
Another question for the sponsor. Is that where we're at, or did you want to finish with the testimony from the legislature? I have a question, but it doesn't have to do with the fiscal note.
Go ahead and ask your question.
Okay. Just on your graph about the total candidates filed for Alaska House that drops off, it seems like there. My reaction is that I just don't see this as proof that cause is a 90-day session. So what my reaction is, I kind of think that's a little bit over the edge. You know, and I just wanted you to explain it, why it's in there, because there could be a lot of factors why people don't run for office, and to imply that the reason they're not running for office is we've gone from 120-day to 90-day seems like a stretch to me. So
maybe they're just so pleased with all of us who've been elected that they see no need to run. Representative Seaton.
In response to the question, the reason this is in here is because this is one of the three arguments that were presented in the pamphlet for going to a 90-day session, because it would increase the number of candidates that would run for office. And so this is just trying to get back and check to see whether the reason for that was proposed for instituting a 90-day session turned out to be factual and correct. And for whatever reason we've had this decrease, it obviously shows that the 90-day session hasn't increased the number of candidates that have been running for office since it's been in effect. I'm not in any way saying that the 90-day session was responsible for this. It was just the fact that that was one of the three arguments used for going to a 90-day session, and it hasn't turned out to stimulate more candidates to run for office than previously. That's the only reason it's here.
We just have fewer candidates running, and why, we don't know, but apparently there's no connection to 90 versus 120 or 120 versus 90. There must be other reasons out there.
Mr. Chairman, there could be other reasons. I don't think that we can say it was
there's
a
90-day,
no, wasn't, but we can say that 90-day session did not stimulate a greater number of candidates to run for office.
Nor did it stimulate fewer.
We can't say. All we can say is these are the facts, and that the reasoning that we should have a 90-day session is because more people would run for office did not materialize, and that's all this is showing is the data.
Representative Keller.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, in response, thank you. I just for the benefit of your staff, she did a good job explaining that too. It's just that I wanted to highlight it. Thank you.
Very good. Representative Grunberg.
Yeah, two things. Just for the record, the statement that we're referring to is in our bill packet from the election pamphlet. And if I may quote, Senator Wagner wrote this: reducing the time away from family and other work might encourage people to run for office. Competition and choice only helps the democratic process and ultimately might boost the caliber of candidates. That engendered the look at the
discussion we've had here.
And secondly, the statute that we're repealing is also appears there. May I read what we're repealing for the record?
Yes, as long as it's not too long.
It's very short. It's AS 2405150B. Quote, the legislature shall adjourn from a regular session within 90 consecutive calendar days, including the day the legislature first convenes in that regular session, unquote.
Okay. Did you have anything else you could help us with from the LAA?
Nothing more to add here.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Appreciate your comments. Please be available if you have any more. Anybody else is anybody online to testify on this? I've had several emails, and we contacted them last night, invited them to to either come to the meeting or to call in from Anchorage. I've had quite a few pieces of correspondence. I want to make sure that they have an opportunity to comment. Anybody in the audience would like to comment on this? Fair enough. I'll close public testimony. Any comments from the committee? Got a yes or no?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Representative Johansson.
Just one thing, and Representative Peterson mentioned Juneau grappling with the tourist season and the legislative season overlapping. I think that's a problem that my town would love to have, and I don't think you're going to get a big pushback from Juneau. Somehow I think they'll find a way to expand their economy during those 30 days. So I don't think that's an issue.
Okay. Very good. Did you have a comment?
Yeah, whenever.
Representative Keller.
Thank you. I really support the passage of the bill, and the reason is the whole principle of the balance of powers that we all know. It's elementary at some level, but I really want to comment. You got the executive, judicial, legislative, and we're legislative, obviously. And keeping that balance is a really important thing, especially in Alaska, where the Constitution is written to give the governor a significant amount of power. The Department of Law and the Attorney General, I'm going to make a statement here and then qualify it, but they aren't there to protect the citizens of Alaska against excesses of the departments in the executive branch. They just don't, that isn't what they do. They protect Alaskans in the broader sense of protecting our law, which are written by the people's representatives. But it's a very general thing. But specifically, any of us that are legislators deal almost, just regularly with people that are having trouble. The most obvious one is OCS, because it's where government and the family interject. So we sometimes find, at least I have, what I would call subjectively excesses of the department and the divisions. And in order to handle that, to me, the more time we have on task, the more we learn the machine, the more we understand how the executive branch works. It isn't that they're evil, but when you see the way it works, then you're able to stand in the gap between our constituents and the government as a whole. So I would wholeheartedly support the bill going back to 120 days. I think it's very, very important. I have been a staffer or a legislator down here since 1999, and I still get amazed at how much I don't know. Because we, in Alaska, our government, the seat of our government, is quite remote from where my constituents are. So it just takes time on task. It really does. It's the same reason I would oppose term limits, because it just takes time to learn these things and to be able to interact in a way that is effective for our constituents. The people that I have run into in the executive branch, I don't think I've ever met one that I would think that I even thought of was as being evil. It isn't that. It's just that they have a job to do, and they pursue it. And as with all of us, we have the capability of missing the ways that our actions may hurt people. And so I just argue both for the role of the legislature, that it's very, very important, and that the extra 30 days is a very good thing. Thank you.
There's any Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have found I've been here for when we had 120 days, and I've been here afterwards, and I've found that first of all, it's much harder to pass a bill, because when you shorten the time frame down to 90 days, that's 60 days less time to pass a bill. So that's considerable amount of time that we don't have, and in that time frame, we have less input from the people of the state. Our constituents, we don't have as much time for them. That's 60 days less time that they have to put input and to testify. So that's another reason. I mean, we're in a hurry. We don't have enough time, and so they're limited. We're limited to the amount of time. I see the questions on your face. If we have 30 days less time in 1 year and 30 days less time in the next year, and we can take two years to pass a bill, that's 60 days.
Yeah. Thank you. I didn't have sense enough to think about that. Yeah, Representative Peters.
Wait a minute. I do have some more comments because so the people of the state, our Alaskans, don't have as much time to testify. It's 60 days less time that they are aware of what we're doing up here and have time to give us their input. And it's a big thing. The biggest thing of all that I found is that in 120 days, we have time to go talk to each other. But with 90 days, we're all in committees so much that we can't even get in to talk to each other. And we have to make appointments, and we don't even have time for appointments hardly. So, you know, if I have a bill and I want to talk to someone else about that bill, another legislator, it's very, very difficult to find that time. That sounds ridiculous, but I know you all find that that's true. And also, when we have to pass bills quickly, this is number four, when we have to pass bills quickly, we find that we don't have the time to vet them as well and as long as before, and so we have more unintended consequences that happen. For those four reasons, I think it's very, very important for us to go back to the 120 days.
Thank you very much, and I would basically underscore everything that you said. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I can't really disagree with most all the other points that the members of the committee have made. I just want to say how difficult it is for me to go against the will of the people. The people did vote via the initiative that was passed to limit the session to 90 days. And they're the boss. They're the people that we're supposed to be working for. So I have to take their message very seriously. So it's very, very difficult for me to vote against what the people have told us that they would prefer, and I just wanted to make that point. Thank you.
It seemed to me that we're all subject to the will of the people, no matter how long the session is, and the will of people is, in the House at least, is reflected every 2 years. Representative Gruenberg, and then
thank you, Mr. Chair. Having been here over a period of years under both 120 days and 90 days, I never served when there was no session limit. The vote was close. It was before the legislature had an opportunity to live with 90 days, which we've now done. And I think that 3 years under this has given us, and through us, our constituents and the state, an opportunity to see how well this worked. And I think we've given it a good try. I have brought this matter up to my constituents on a number of occasions, the latest being last night at a community council meeting. And when I talk to people, not universally, because there are some people that say you don't need 90 days, you should be able to get out in 60 or whatever they're saying at the moment, but the vast majority of the people understand that we need to do a professional job down here. We need the time. And this is one aspect of a maturing state, that they understand the problems we have. It's a huge state with a very small population, the smallest legislature in the country to do the job, vast differences across the state, untold resources great responsibility and huge philosophical issues that need careful consideration. This is not a state like Rhode Island, where I just went to a conference, which is very small, and people can get around, even if they're not in session, and talk to each other very easily. Because we live so far apart from Ketchikan to Barrow and everything in between. The only time most of us have a chance really to consider what we're doing is when we are together in the Capitol. And we need the time to really consider what we're doing, to allow our constituents the time to get the word on legislation and be able to testify and write to us. So I support the bill.
Thank you. I would point out that there's no benefit, you know, benefit to any of us as legislators by having a longer session, because we are away, many of us are away from our family. Not everybody brings their family down here. Away from our family, away from home. But for those who have other employment, they're away from that employment. The problems at home continue on while we're down here. So there's no benefit individually to any of our elected representatives to have a longer session. If anything, it's a detriment to us personally, I think, to have a longer session. But those of us who chosen to run for office, those of us who've been selected, we want to do what's best for everybody in the state, even if it's a detriment to us. And I have some closing comments. Who is next? I think Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, you know, our state does have a very robust initiative process, and lots of states don't have that. But an initiative is simply passing a statute by a different mechanism. And, you know, a statute that we pass, we can reverse the next year. There's a restriction on initiatives that they can't be repealed for 2 years, and that's to make sure that the public is empowered and that the law is tested. And we've had 3 years under this. We've seen the effects, and it is incumbent on us to look at the state statutes, however they're initiated. And I would like to point out on the survey, it's page 14 of 16, it's number 36. And that question was, taking into account the effect of the 90-day session on all aspects of the legislative process, does the fact that the session length was established by initiative process affect your willingness to change the session length? And 73%, or 22 representatives, said no. And so, legislatures change. We change people. All we could do is survey the people that had been in, that were in the legislature at the time, which was the charge of the committee by legislative council. We tried to take into account all of the different parameters and attitudes, and this survey was pretty all-encompassing of everything we could, from personal lives to how it affected constituents to how it affected the legislative process. And so I would just like to say that I think that there's the recommendation that has come forward to stimulate this bill is a recommendation that came out of the majority of the House respondents. And, you know, the committee sure appreciated all the respondents giving their answers and their additional comments, because that was able for us then to form a basis for coming to the legislature and saying, you know, this is a considered opinion by this broad group of legislators in the House. And so that's why we brought the bill forward. And thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, I think we've all received communication from our constituents and from others, and it's been pretty much across the board. Continuing the 90 days, going back to 120. So we not only listen to each other, but We've listened to our constituents, too. And any other comments? If not, Representative Keller?
Thank you. I would move sponsor substitute for House Bill 71, version LS0377, Bravo, with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes out of committee.
Okay. Any objection? If not, Bill passes on committee. I'd like to thank the, I guess it'd be committee, a subcommittee work group, or whatever you call it, for the work they did on this. It was well put together.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
This bill, next stop in this bill is the House Finance Committee. With that, we're going to go to our next bill on the agenda, SB 33, a disposition of service members remains. And who's going to present that bill? Yes. Good morning, sir. Please identify yourself.
For the record, my name is Michael Caulfield. I'm an intern in Senator Wilikowski's office, and I'd like to thank Chair Lynn and the House State Affairs Committee for hearing this bill.
How long have you interned?
Since January.
Since January?
So 5 weeks.
And how many bills have you testified on?
This one several times.
Oh, okay. be prepared.
All right.
Okay. Please continue, sir.
In these times of war, it is vital that we hold service members to the highest regard and treat them with all the respect that they deserve. This is never more important than in honoring their final wishes in the tragic event of their death while on duty. The Department of Defense requires active duty service members, reservists, and guard members to complete a record of emergency data form annually or prior to deployment in which they stipulate who should manage their remains in the event of their death. The Coast Guard, which falls outside the Department of Defense but follows the same federal statutes, has her own form, the designation of beneficiaries and a record of emergency data. Unfortunately, many states, including Alaska, do not comply with these forms because no laws exist that recognize legal designees as the person in charge of the remains. Instead, they default to predetermined lists, generally starting with the spouse. Clearly, this can lead to disputes where the person named on the form differs from the automatic default, and they both wish to have authority over the remains. These situations can draw out an already painful process of mourning and burial. Senate Bill 33 solves this problem by amending Alaska statutes to recognize the person named on the emergency data forms as the primary manager of the remains. This will stop disputes over who should have authority and help protect against the worst-case scenario when no one can be found to deal with the remains. 20 states already have laws which comply with the federal form, and in our doing so, we will be able to ensure that our heroic soldiers' remains are handled by the person they truly desired. This bill is supported by the Alaska Veterans Association, the Office of the Deputy Undersecretary of Defense, the Alaska Chapter of Vietnam Veterans of America, the National Funeral Directors Association, and I'd also like to add that Mark Sansusi from the Office of the Deputy Undersecretary of Defense and Rick Davidge from the Vietnam Vets for America should be available to provide additional testimony in support of this bill. I'd urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions?
I have one.
Representative Grunberg.
Good job testifying.
Thank you.
And my only question is, I don't see from the record that there's any opposition. Has anybody given any reason against the bill?
We have not heard any opposition, no.
Just wanted that for the record. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess my question to you is if the person, the man or woman, is married,
mm-hmm.
and then they put somebody else as the person that they want to take their remains and put them wherever, that to me would cause a lot of problems if it happened to me and I was the one back home. So what's the justification there if they're married? If they're not married, I can see doing all this, but you don't differentiate if they're married or not.
Well, through the chair, I forgot that last time. Representative Wilson, what can happen is, so say you're married or a soldier is married, but he's estranged from his wife, and so they haven't been together, haven't spoken in 2 years, but they're still technically married. and then he would die overseas, his remains would automatically legally fall to her to handle, even if he wanted his parents to handle his remains. So this bill makes it so he can designate his parents as the people who will handle his remains instead of his wife, who he hasn't seen for 2 years.
Follow up? And I can see in a situation like that also, but what about the times when during the process that the person, he or she, has been overseas and found somebody else that they decide to like, and then the wife doesn't even, or the husband doesn't even know about it, and this comes up?
Through the chair, so you mean if he changes who he wants to designate without telling the person? That is a question. I mean, I would have to have refer that to Mark Sansusi, who will be available to testify. But I can't imagine selecting someone who you don't even notify. But I'll have to just refer that question to Mark Sansusi.
Okay.
Follow up.
That does happen, mm-hmm. And so that's where I'm concerned about when a wife or a husband. They don't even realize that there's something else going on. And I would think that this would be just devastating. So I have a concern for that situation.
And I think, through the chair, I think it's important that, we try and make this as comfortable and as, a good or, as good as it can be experience for everyone. But I think it's very important to honor the actual soldiers' wishes to who they wish to manage their remains.
Right. The person is alive, of course. The body belongs to that person, in a manner of speaking.
Mm-hmm.
And it would seem to me that the individual involved has a right to determine where their remains will go mm-hmm. upon their death.
Mm-hmm.
More so than anybody else in the world, married or not.
Yeah.
Representative Johansson, I believe.
I'll pass.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So if I understand it correctly, if a military member does change the person that they want to dispose of their remains, the Army does not notify the person that was originally designated that there has been a change? Is that the current situation?
I through the chair, Representative Peterson, I will have to refer that to Mark Sansusi on if the military does notify the people that has been selected as being.
Okay. If there's no more, let's go, if you'd like, to Mr. Sansusi. Are you online, sir?
Yes, good morning, Mr. Chair and committee. Thank you. My name is Mark Sansusi. I'm the regional liaison for military families for the Undersecretary of Defense for Personnel and Readiness. I've been listening to the discussion, and Michael did a great job being concise, so I won't be redundant. But through the chair, Representative Wilson, the situation is like this. The DD 493 allows the service member to choose between a surviving spouse, a blood relative, or an adopted relative. And they do this form at least annually and certainly before they deploy and on a regular basis, because it's an emergency data form that has other questions on it in case of some kind of tragedy. So in the situation which you represent, the person can only choose a spouse or a blood relative, like a mother or a brother or an adopted relative. If that person had a relationship, a girlfriend or someone else, they're not even allowed to put that person on the form. So I would submit that kind of event couldn't happen because that person is not a spouse, not a blood relative, not an adopted relative. So that would not happen. And as to when the for Representative Peterson, I believe, through the chair. Whenever the person executes the DD 493 emergency data form, if that person were to decide to just change it because the time has come to change, or we're getting ready to deploy, and put down a brother and not the spouse. I don't believe that the military has an obligation to notify the spouse. If the spouse is still legally married, they're going to get the other benefits also. So I hope that clears up a little bit. Relationships that are not spouse or blood relative or adopted relative will not be recognized. So I'd like to think that would not happen. I stand by for any other questions, please.
Okay. Any questions from Mr. Sonsi? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I really appreciate your answer, and that's good to know the way that the Armed Services takes care of it. I'm pleased with that.
Very good. There's no further question. I'd like to thank you for your testimony, sir. Rick Davidge, are you there?
Mr. Chairman, can you hear me?
Yes, you can. This is Rick. Rick Davidge?
Yes. Rick Davidge, Vietnam Veterans of America. We've been actively involved in this legislation.
First of all, I'd like to thank you for your service, sir.
And thank you for your service, sir. We've been actively involved with Senator Wachowski as well as Representative Thomas on this bill. And certainly if you have any questions, we've been engaged on some cases with some of these issues, principally as chairman of the Alaska Veterans Foundation. You think it's difficult dealing with an active service member. It's even worse dealing with a veteran who's been out of touch with their family for years and died. Last year we had a two-tour Marine, highly decorated, died in his home. We made an extraordinary effort to locate next of kin. We were unable to do that, and so the service member was interned with an honor guard on behalf of the Veterans of America of Alaska. But these kinds of things happened, and I'm delighted that the state is now coming into compliance with the federal forms. Every member has an obligation to update this annually, and every time before you go overseas, you have to go through and redo these forms. So hopefully it best reflects the intention of the member.
Any questions?
I have a question.
Reverend Grunberg, you've been going through the statute books here. What did you find?
Well, okay.
He memorizes these things.
This is going to be for Mr. Sanssouci.
Mr. Sanssouci, are you still there?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I am.
Okay.
I'm a lawyer by trade, but a family lawyer, not a probate lawyer. You know, the wishes of a person as to what to do with their remains is an intensely personal issue. And all sorts of sub-issues can become involved, such as whether to donate their remains for an anatomical gift or for how to dispose of them, cremate or whatever, for religious or whatever purposes. And I would think that a choice of what to do and who should do that is an intensely personal choice as well. And my question is really to you concerning the federal law. If a serviceman or woman writes a will or some other document and wants somebody other than those listed relatives to make the decision, let's say the person dies of cancer here in Alaska at home, even though they're on active duty, federal law limits what they can do with their remains and trumps state law. Is that correct legally, sir, through the chair?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair. The form is congressionally mandated, whereas a will is not. And sometimes a will can be in a refrigerator for 10 years and way out of date. Processing a will through probate is not intended to conflict with the designation of the PAD. So if in fact and I'm not an attorney, so I'm just an old retired guy like the chair. The PAT is supposed to ensure the smooth process of laying the remains to rest without causing dispute among the family. In terms of trying to answer the question, because the DD 93 is thought to be or frequently more current, then that's where the military service would go. But I have been counseled that if in fact there was a will that was recent and it conflicted with the 93, then it would probably end up in litigation. That's what I have been briefed on. Whenever there is a conflict. However, again, I like to pose the caveat that sometimes the wills are dated, whereas the 93, each individual has gotten a thorough briefing when they do the 93 in terms of communicating to who they designate their preferences for cremation, burial, what state you want it to be in, and all that kind of stuff. So I hope this somewhat answers your question, Representative Bloomberg.
It factually does, and I support the bill here, and will vote to do pass on it. But I am concerned just generally that the decedent's wishes be followed as closely as possible. Normally, if a person has an outdated will, and then drafts, signs another later document, that document will supersede the earlier document. It's a question of the last in time prevails. It sounds to me, though, like this federal law would limit the individual's choice in that matter, but I don't know. Thank you for the answer. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Johansson, then we're going to make some decisions after that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the backup, it talks about this very issue, and it mentions that 10 states in their statute currently recognize the DD-93 as the official way to go about it, and absent that statutory reference, it goes back to the states. According to this information, to the state's order of disposition of apparently non-military folks. So, and I don't know if the state of Alaska has designated the DD-93 as the official way to go about doing this or not, but according to this backup, which is right, it's right after the, these aren't numbered, but it's after... There's the fiscal note, and there's 1, 2, 3, 4, fifth page, USA for military families, comport state laws with DOD rules on disposition, explains exactly what's going on. So maybe something that the sponsor might want to look at to include in this at some point down the line, if we designate in our state that this form is the official default for service members, and I'm not sure if the committee wants to talk about that now or if we want to hold on to it and contemplate it or if the sponsor would take that under consideration as it journeys through the rest of the legislature. I'm not sure.
Mr. Chair, if I could interject.
Please identify yourself.
Yes, sir. Mark Santucci, Department of Defense representative through the chair. That comes from the USA for Military Families website. That is our website. There are around 20 to 21 states that recognize the DD-93. Last year, 10 states passed into law recognizing the 93. And when we did a study of this in 2009, when we took this on as one of our top 10 key issues, the attorneys who looked at this felt that 9 states had sufficient latitude the way their statutes were written to recognize the 93. Or the DD-93. I also would add, and I was trying to be brief and not testifying, 11 states this year, including yours, are taking this up this year to recognize the DD-93. I think what the intention of this legislation is is exactly for Alaska to recognize the DD-93 or its successor military form to honor the desires of the person who died on active duty.
Very good. Okay. Anybody else online to testify? Anybody else in the audience would like to testify on this?
You may have responded.
To whom?
Representative Johansson.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I appreciate that. Representative Johansson, this is the document you're referring to? Yeah. Okay. That really answers my question. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to close public testimony. Mr. Navage, we're going to have another bill following this one. I may have a couple of questions for you on that one, even though I don't think you signed up for it.
Mr. Ravage is no longer on that.
He is on that?
He is no longer on that.
Oh, okay. Well, so much for that. Okay. Public testimony, any comments around the table? If not, Representative Keller?
I'm ready to move the bill, Mr. Chair. If
you're ahead.
Okay, I move CS, or Senate Bill 33, State Affairs Version, LS-0188 Delta. From committee with accompanying fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Okay. Without objection, bill passed. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You did a good job. You can continue your internship.
Thank you.
Okay. The next item on the agenda is HB 92, Lao Veterans License Plates. And who's going to introduce that bill? Go ahead. You may introduce it from here or there, wherever you want to do it.
I'll just do it from here, so it'll be quicker. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the State Affairs Committee, and thank you for the hearing on HB 92. Like a few other bills we've heard this session, HB 92 deals with creating a special license plate. This license plate would be in honor of Hmong veterans who fought with and for the United States during the Vietnam War. During this time, the CIA organized a Hmong army in Laos, which performed important combat support missions for the U.S. military, including rescuing U.S. pilots whose planes were shot down and disrupting North Vietnamese supply lines along the Ho Chi Minh Trail. As a result, the Hmong people faced persecution and even genocide after the U.S. withdrawal from Southeast Asia. Many Hmong who left Asia ended up in the United States and were granted asylum under the Indochina Migration and Refugee Assistance Act of 1975, with many becoming proud American citizens. We have a growing Hmong population in Alaska, and this will be one small way to show our respect and appreciation for their service and assistance in the Vietnam War. And my legislative aide, David Bremer, will
introduce yourself, please.
My name is David Bremer, staff to Representative Peterson.
A little closer to the mic, please.
David Bremer, staff to Representative Peterson, here to answer any questions you or the committee might have.
Representative Johansson.
Thank you. May I remind you that you are on the record?
I am on for the record.
What's it really like working for Representative Peterson? Shall we put him under oath, Mr. Chairman?
Would you raise your right hand? No.
I'm just kidding.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like you, David, and Representative Peterson, to look at the language of the bill, lines 6 and 7 on page 1 versus page the first line of your sponsor statement. And it seems to me that the language of the bill, commemorating the owner's service in combat in support of U.S. military operations in the Kingdom of Laos, that's what the bill says. But line 1 of the sponsor statement says that the bill recognizes and honors Lao veterans who fought in support of the United States. I believe that the language of the bill could be read as including Americans who fought in Laos in support of military operations, as opposed to people who were Laotian. Was it your intent, and I'll, if I have a little lead from the acting chair here, to ask both these gentlemen, was it your intent to allow Americans to get these places, or to limit this to Laotians?
Through the chair, Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. These veterans were of Laotian descent when they were fighting, but they have immigrated to the United States because of persecution for political reasons, because in fact they were helping us back then, and after we left back in 75, you know, thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, were killed, people who had supported us then. And so many of them who were not killed immigrated here to America. And there is a growing population of them in Alaska. I believe it's 4,500 or 4,700 is what the last count that we had here in Alaska. And obviously some of these are the family and children of these veterans, but there are many of the veterans themselves who are still alive and living here.
If I may follow up. I understand, and I thought that was your intention, and I co-sponsored the bill, of course, I support it. But the language of the bill itself does not seem to limit it to Laotians, because it seems to me, and I know from what I've watched on the military channel and stuff, that there were a number of Americans over there who were supporting military operations. They were members of our armed forces. They just happened to be fighting in Laos.
Representative Aramerica,
Peterson, through the chair.
Thank
just
you,
trying
Mr.
to
Chairman.
Keep, you know, for the record.
Representative
Gruenberg.
Through the chair. If it's your intention to limit it to Laotians, it seems to me that you might check legally with our bill drafter to see if this language should be narrowed a bit by inserting a word of, we're talking here about people who were from the Kingdom of Laos and not Americans who were doing that. I just want to be sure that this doesn't cut more broadly than you're intending by your statement.
And through the chair, Mr. Gruenberg, Representative Gruenberg.
Identify yourself.
David Bremer, staff to Representative Peterson for the record. I believe if the intent is American of Laotian descent who fought in Laos are already eligible for veteran license plates, American veteran. And so the intent of this legislation was to provide people who weren't American citizens at the time but fought in support of U.S. military operations to honor their service to America.
Through the chair, just to follow up. I think that's your intent, but I think that the literal language of this might allow non-Laotians who fought in Laos in combat in support of the military operations. It's just something you might check with the bill drafters and might require an amendment at some point.
On that point, Representative Seaton?
I'll let this. I'll follow.
Can I answer that, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So you're thinking that we might need a title change?
No.
Oh.
If I may. No, not a title change. Through the chair. Through the chair.
Yes,
no.
Sure.
Some language, and I'd be prepared to make the amendment if it was appropriate to do it, or whatever you wish. Something to say, for the example, that would make it, I don't even know how I would say it, but that it's intended to apply to Laotians, not to Americans who did this. And it's just to effectuate your intention and exclude the Americans who were over there doing this. Because I think it's clearly the intent to help the Laotian community.
Through the chair, that is the intent.
Representative Peterson, I'm sorry.
I said through the chair that was the intent.
State the intent then, please, for the record.
To allow Laotian veterans to get these license plates, who obviously have to have emigrated here to the United States and to Alaska to obviously to be here to get one of these plates.
Okay.
We're not intending to have former Air America personnel to get these license plates, but I don't know if they wanted to get one of those, I suppose they probably could order one if they wanted to honor their service in having fought in Laos.
Through the chair.
A question related that Representative Grunberg has, it's more complex because we can't document that anybody was in, was there, you know. And so, I mean, there is a distinction in how somebody from Laos would certify themselves as being eligible than it would be for a U.S. citizen that was over there. How he or she would document that they were there would be significantly different than a Laotian, as I understand it. There were several others waiting here. I think Representative Seaton and then Representative Johansson.
Thank you. On the wording on line 7, it says the owner's service. So apparently if someone leases a car, they can't get this. I don't think that's the intent, but I don't know if that's there. And also the sponsor said that there are many descendants of folks that moved here, and this is just the owner and just the person that served, it appears. So if you are wanting to have this being someone honoring their relative that served in Laos as their father or mother, I'm not sure that the wording that you have allows that. So I just wanted to bring that up for your consideration.
Response, Representative Peterson?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, that's I'm glad you pointed that out, because if someone wanted to honor a relative of theirs who had served and possibly maybe was killed in combat helping America back then, maybe I certainly wouldn't want to deter them from getting one of these plates. So we might want to consider changing the wording on that line.
Representative Johansson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You hit on the point. My main question is, how do we know? I mean, maybe the sponsor can explain what sort of documentation someone would have to bring to DMV, or is it just somebody that says, hey, I was over there fighting for you guys, and I want my license plate. So can you explain the process? Looks like you have an answer.
Through the chair, Representative Johansson.
Identify yourself again, just to make it easier for the...
David Rummer, staff to Representative Peterson, for the record, through the chair, Representative Johansson. There have been several criteria laid out by the federal government during the Hmong Veterans Naturalization Act of 2000, which allowed veterans in Laotian in the secret war during that time to exempt them from English language testing and citizenship test. So they go down to original documents, basically maybe orders with their name on it given to them from the U.S. government, or an affidavit signed by their superior officer at the time, or two affidavits from people who served with them or knew of their service in Laos, and then other appropriate proof such as pictures of them in training or uniforms, or them with certain Laotian generals.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Representative Peterson, I'm a little bit confused. Is it your intention to allow Americans, people from the United States who were over there fighting, to get these plates, or to limit it strictly to people who were Laotian?
Representative Peterson.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, my intent was to had a request from someone from my district who thought that since we have a large number of license plates honoring veterans from that served in other wars, that he thought it would be appropriate if we could have a plate that would honor his service in to help this country back many, many years ago. in Southeast Asia. And so I was just trying to introduce a simple bill to allow that to happen. And so if we do have to adjust the language in this bill to satisfy his request, then I'm willing to do that.
Yeah. Before you continue, that I think it's getting obvious, I think, to the committee that, you know, you will take at least one more hearing to clarify the intent and the language,
right.
You know. And so further questioning on this, if you have it, if you for the record, that's just fine. But we want to also get to if there's any other questions. But Representative Grunberg.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think that's a good idea to get exactly what you want. I think, just looking at it, this would probably be read as allowing a United States person from Alaska or California, wherever, and who served in Laos and could prove it, to get one of these plates. It doesn't appear on its face to me, just as a person reading it, that it's limited to Laotian citizens, people who were from Laos. And if that's your intent, this may well do it if your intent was instead to just narrow it to Laotian folks. Then that might require something, but that's something for you to consider. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And just for the committee, we have Whitney Brewster here from the division, and I'm hoping she's forming opinions and statements here that can, you know, give us wisdom. But are there any other questions on this bill that you'd like to address, Representative Johansson?
Well, just between now and the next hearing, I just want to make sure that we have a good train of information. I mean, I'm not that familiar with who served over there or under what capacity, but I have visions of, we've got people down in Ketchikan, part of the Filipino community, who got on airplanes in the 80s and were freedom fighters and flew over there, and they were basically rebels. I mean, I don't know. I mean, are we talking about civilians that hopped on a plane and flew over there? Are we talking about people that served directly under the United States military or Laos military or whatever? So I'm going to have to figure this out because, you know, I just don't want to be giving license plates away for something as important and personal as a war. I don't want people driving around Alaska with these license plates on telling stories. I mean, that's disrespectful to the people who are actually over there serving. So I just want to make sure I understand all the little particulars before I support this.
Is it on that point? Okay, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, you know, on page 1, line 11, where it goes, the owner must present evidence satisfactory to the department that the owner served in combat as required by this subsection. And that says the department can disapprove the issuance of the plates under this subsection if there is a duplicate of an existing registration. But it does say to evidence satisfactory to the department.
Before we go to Whitney, if there's no more questions, I'd just like to say thank you to the sponsor for bringing this forward, because obviously this is an uncomfortable time of our history to look back on, the whole Vietnam War, but the Hmong people really stuck their neck out for America and got left holding the bag when the politics, this is subjective and you may disagree, but from my perspective, you know, we pulled out, and they were left, enemies at home with their own people. And so, you know, I commend you for bringing the bill forward, and I would encourage you to continue to pursue the options and try to get rid of the gray areas where you can. So, Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was in Vietnam. I was on an LST, a landing ship, a large landing ship. And we were at one time in an invasion, landing folks on the beach, but nobody opposed us. So we were not entitled to the combat action ribbon, or if I'd been in the Army, the combat infantryman award, because it wasn't considered, quote, in combat. That is a very, very technical term in military stuff. So you may very well find there are people over there who were supporting this, and they may have been in the supply area or in communications, but they weren't technically in combat. And I think that you may want to clarify that, too, so that if the guy wasn't or the woman wasn't out there shooting a gun, but was very much involved in the conflict, that they would be eligible to it, for it, too. Because as I think everybody knows, for every one person that's out flying the helicopter or the fighter pilot here, which we have two of them right here on our committee.
Not in Vietnam.
We're talking about the Civil War.
Civil War.
The,
no wars are civil. They're all hostile.
And these, I don't mean to, these are very good guys over here.
Yeah, I think, oh, go ahead.
Continue. That you cast your net with all, so all appropriate people can get it.
Good point. Mr. Chair, I was just finishing up. David, I think, is done, and I think the committee is pretty well done. The bill is, we're going to be more work on it, but we would like to hear from Whitney while she's here.
I apologize for having him to leave. I'm not quite sure at all, dude. I had a comment, and so. So what are we going to do? We're going to hold it, or
we're going to hold it, and it's going to be worked on. But if you have a comment or a question, I think it's good to get it on the record so it can be worked on.
Yeah, I was in Vietnam, like many others, and of course, I had little or no contact with the Hmong warriors. Nothing but praise for what these people do. I don't have any direct knowledge, but I've heard many, many good things about these folks. And not only that, but how they've assimilated into American society since they've come here. My hat's off to them. I was in Vietnam, and some of the people I worked with actually didn't work with them so much as had them next door and over in their villages from time to time with the Moton Yards. We call them the Yards, but the Moton Yard, that translated, that means mountain people. I think they call it Dagar or Daga people now. They've changed their name on it, and they were great, great allies of the Americans in Vietnam. And of course, you have the Hmong, and you have the Moton Yards, and other tribes, the Mayo tribes, northern Thailand. You know, all these borders over there, the Vietnam border, the Laotian border, the Cambodian border, the Burma border, the Thai, all, many of these lines are just arbitrary lines are drawn on the map by some international group. And these, for lack of a better term, these tribes, Mayo, Votan Yard, Hmong, others, many others, they didn't pay too much attention to national borders. They're kind of in the whole Southeast Asia area. And many of these people, the Hmongs for sure, and the Moton Yards were very, very great allies of the American cause. Extreme warriors. I had a chance to go into a couple of their villages, and I was told that I'd never be any safer place in the world than to be in a Moton Yard village. And very impressed with these people. And they were extremely persecuted by the Vietnamese natives, I guess you would say, and have been since we left Vietnam and the communists took over. And so I'm wondering if any consideration was given to either having a separate plate for the Moton Yards, perhaps some of the other indigenous tribes, other than the Hmong. That's not to lessen what the Hmongs did. But a lot of these people really, really did help us save a lot of American life. I don't have a clue at how many Moton Yards may be in the Anchorage or Alaska area. I know there's quite a, quote, colony of these folks in, I think it's South Carolina, of all places. But did any comment on that? Representative Peterson, did you comment on it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's actually a large community in the state of Wisconsin as well.
The Moton Yard.
Yes. Well, and actually,
by the way, I've got a Moton Yard bracelet that I used to wear proudly when I was in Vietnam.
And David actually probably has a handout to give you that explains a little bit about that Moton Yard term and where it came from. And it's actually a term coined by the French colonials, meaning mountain people.
Yes.
And it actually did refer to the Hmong who lived in the mountains in Southeast Asia. And like you said, they were they lived in the mountains, and the mountains went across borders. So there was there some were from Laos, and some may have been from some of the other countries.
But, so I wonder, because many the Hmong did a marvelous job helping the Americans, especially in the Laotian area. And I don't know. I know the Monyard did great work too. I don't know. They kind of all these people are living in all the same areas, regardless of where the lines were drawn on this thing. And in your research, did you think of maybe just having a Monyard plate, a Hmong plate, or some other name? How would you address this, or should it be addressed?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Hmong is a broader term, and the Montagne Guard term was more of a colloquial expression used by the French. So,
well, they had their own name. They call it Degar now.
But the Hmong would be a broader group of it would bring in be a. A larger net, so to speak, versus the Montagne Guards.
Yeah, the Montagne Guards.
Montagne Guards.
The Montagne Guards agreed to that.
I don't. I actually don't know if we've specifically talked to any.
David Bremer, Chair Lynn, I don't believe had input from the Degar community, but the term Montagne Guard was used by the French. To refer to any mountain people, not just the Degar people. It was to Degar, the Hmong, anybody who lived in the mountains. So it was more, as Representative Peterson said, a colloquial term as opposed to an actual name for their tribe or their people or who they were, their culture.
Well, as we go into this, and we're going to examine it further, I would appreciate it if somebody could actually get in touch with some of the Montagne Guard. And I consider the word Montagne Guard people to see if they buy into this.
Okay.
They're pretty, all, as we are very proud of our ethnic groups, all of us, they're very proud of their own individual groups also. Okay. What we recommend that we hold the bill?
Yeah, I'd recommend we hold the bill and we hear from Whitney, and we have one testifier waiting, too. So.
Okay, Ms. Brewster, would you like to join us?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name
Welcome
is Whitney
back
Brewster.
To Juneau, by the way.
Thank you very much. It's good to be back in Juneau. For the record, my name is Whitney Brewster. I'm the director of the Division of Motor Vehicles. Conceptually, the DMV does not oppose the legislation. We just want to be able to carry it out. So the topic of evidence provided to the DMV is very important for me to find out about. We want to be able to honor those that you would like for us to honor. The way that I currently read the bill, anyone who served during this time period in the Kingdom of Laos would be eligible for this plate. If it is the intent to have this plate specific to Laotians, I think that it for the DMV's comfort would probably need to have the bill amended. If it is the intent to also expand it to any family member to get the plate in honor of someone who has served, we can certainly administer that as well. But I think that the bill would also need to be amended to include that. Through the chair, Representative Seaton, to answer your specific question about would renters be able to get these plates on their vehicles, perhaps instead of owner, we could insert the word applicant. That might satisfy that concern. With that, I'm happy to answer any other questions.
I just might say I'm a little cautious about going too far with this, where we start identifying ethnic groups, racial groups, if you will, for various license plates, because that's a path I'm not sure we want to go down. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Brewster, thank you. Your testimony is very helpful. My question to you is, if this bill were to pass basically like it is, or whatever changes we were to make, would you currently have regulatory authority to do what's in the bill, or do we need to have something in there that says that the department or the division has the authority to adopt regulations to carry this provision out?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, I believe that the DMV does have yet regulatory powers to be able to carry out the bill.
Through the chair, I thought you did, but I wanted that on the record. If there's any question, I think it is, but if your answer were to change, please let us know or let the sponsor know.
Okay. Do we have Stacey Oates available? Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was going to ask Ms. Brewster, and we have numerous different types of plates that some people can apply for now, veteran-type plates. What type of documentation do they have to provide to get these plates that are currently in use?
Through the chair, Representative Peterson, for instance, the Gold Star family plate, those who have been killed in action, any papers that the family member has from the Department of Defense, an obituary would satisfy the evidence requirement to be able to be eligible for that plate. But essentially anything that has been issued, discharge papers for some of the other plates would be satisfactory evidence. Those listed by your staff, that was very helpful to hear what currently exists or what might be used to provide evidence. We could certainly use that criteria to as evidence of eligibility for the plate.
Thank you.
Because, of course, the Hmong warriors wouldn't have a discharge from the Americans. Okay. Ms. Oates, did you want to testify? I have a yes here.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Stacey Oates, and I'm with the Division of Motor Vehicles also, and I am here to answer questions.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Okay. Is anybody else in the audience who would like to testify? Anybody online? If not, very interesting bill, and I'm going to close testimony on that bill for now. We will probably hear this at a future State Affairs Committee hearing. And our next hearing is Thursday, February 17th, HB 98, handling of the state flag, HB 111, license plate, choose life, HB 74, very interesting bill, information on matters in election pamphlets. So no other business come before the committee. I will adjourn at about 7 minutes of.